Our story begins in a fabled land much like any other. Living in this land were kings and queens and their beautiful princess daughters, servants, peasants, the occasional witch, wizard, or warlock, and of course, a healthy population of strapping young men who all saw themselves as heroes if only they could ever have the chance to prove their worth. There were many dangers in this land as well, both large and small. A rich man who forgot to leave an offering at a wayside shrine might find himself accosted at the next bridge by the troll who dwelt beneath it. The troll might have been satisfied with the handful of small coins that should have been the offering, but once roused out of his den, the rich but unwary traveler would end up parting with far more, particularly if the troll happened to be hungry. The larger dangers were all as one might expect to hear tell of in tales, but never to see oneself. There were dragons in the mountains, it was said, who lay dormant on their beds of gold and jewels for years before setting out unexpectedly one night to ravage the countryside with teeth and talons and fire. There were leviathans in every lake, and trickster demons haunting every crossroad, even if one never saw them. Someone else did, once, and told a tale in a tavern, and while the other patrons might scoff, they were also careful never to swim beyond where their feet could touch the mud of the lake bottom, and certainly they were never foolish enough to make wishes while passing through crossroads. The subject of our tale now was a man of exceedingly humble origin and station in life, who never once thought of himself as a hero and would have laughed himself hoarse at the very notion. He was a poacher, a man of the forest, skilled at tracking and hunting and trapping, and also quite often at hiding from the king's men, who would blunder through the woods from time to time seeking criminals such as himself. He knew very well the small dangers that the forest held, how one must never step into a mushroom circle to be taken by mischievous fairies to their strange and wondrous realm, perhaps never to return, how one must never trap an animal clad all in white, no matter what price such a lovely fur might fetch at market, for they were the living spirits of the forest, and to kill such a creature would cause the forest to turn on the one who did it. In his first year living on his own in the woods, our poacher had seen a white fox, and knowing what that meant, bowed his head in reverence. When he looked up, it was gone, but he followed the fox's trail to a small shrine created from the stump of an ancient tree, where he left an apple, a single silver coin, and a lock of his hair. From that day on, the forest seemed a kinder place to him, and he dwelt there with ease. Well, most of the time. For there was one more small danger in the forest, one to which, perhaps, he was particularly susceptible. From time to time, as he lay beside his tiny, well-tended campfire at night, he would hear a soft murmuring. He could never make out any words, for the sound seemed to be many voices, all hushed, speaking to each other in tones of wonder and shy excitement. Whenever he heard these voices, seeming to be at once far off, but somehow only just beyond sight, he was seized with an almost overpowering urge to douse his fire, strip away his clothes, and walk naked among the trees. The first time, he didn't come to his senses until he had already laid aside his coat and shirt and was struggling with the laces of his boots. When one of the laces snapped and cut his finger, the sight of the blood brought him back to himself, and he lay restless through the whole of that night, wondering what it was he had almost done. The next time it happened, months later, he was ready, having heard a tale at a tavern on one of his trips to market. That second time, he knew what called to him, and he resisted with all the strength of his will. It was a troop of wood nymphs out there in the darkness beyond his fire. They would not approach, for they feared the touch of the flames, but they preyed upon human men, and what he heard was their delighted chatter at happening upon one, and their attempts to lure him from the safety of his camp. Many times over the years the same scene would play out. Our poacher would startle awake at the sound of the nymph's laughter, hastily build up the fire, and sit hunched with a burning brand held tightly in his fist, ready to wave in the face of any nymph brave enough to risk coming closer. Not a one ever did, but he was ready nonetheless. Sometime in the hour before dawn, the troop would retreat, their excitement fading to disappointment, their voices fading to silence. Only when the sun was up would he let the fire die and curl back up on his bedroll for some much-needed sleep. It wasn't as if he weren't at all tempted, for he was. He did not often feel the touch of a woman, and sometimes, listening to the nymphs, his body ached for it. He was a handsome enough man, and on occasion a friendly barmaid might succumb to his smile and his bright blue eyes, or perhaps a rebellious innkeeper's daughter would knock softly on the door to his room, urging him to be quiet lest her father hear them. But those were fleeting encounters, and he knew quite well there was no woman who would choose to live as he did, hunting and tracking and trapping alongside him in the forest. Poaching was oft-times a lucrative profession, but it was always a lonely one. Though he knew that to follow the nymphs would mean his end, he also knew that before they drained him dry of all of his essence, whether it took days or weeks or months, while they did, at least, he would be sated by their attentions. Some nights, listening to their soft, excited voices, it seemed as if it might be worth the trade. It was after just such a night in the first breath of autumn that we find the poacher sleeping by the cold remains of his burnt-out campfire, his face dappled with the little sunlight that fell through the tangled mass of the canopy above him. His exhausted slumber was interrupted quite suddenly when he felt the touch of a hand upon his face. Rolling to his feet, he reached for the knife at his belt before he even opened his eyes to discover the identity of the hand's owner. As soon as he did open his eyes, that knife was at her throat. The poacher found himself gazing upon a wood nymph for the very first time. Despite the fact that he had never seen one before, he knew it was impossible that she should be anything else. Her eyes were wide and dark, a brown as deep and rich as the loam of the forest floor. Her skin, by contrast, was birch pale. She had no hair as a human woman would, but instead a tumble of leaves that spilled from the crown of her head down over her shoulders and back. Most were still a vibrant green, but a few framing her face were just beginning to turn yellow as summer gave way to fall. The man's eyes followed the cascade of greenery down her naked form, which was as supple as a willow branch bending before the wind. Her breasts were small and pointed, her hips slender, her legs long and shapely. She spoke suddenly, her tone lilting and musical. The poacher couldn't understand her, though, and looked back up to her face to try to glean some meaning from her expression. She did not seem frightened, despite the knife pressed against the pale skin of her neck. If anything, the poacher thought, she seemed amused. He withdrew the knife, returning it to his belt as he took a step back. Questions swirled through his mind, though he asked none of them aloud, for he knew he would get no answer, at least none that he would understand. Why was she alone? Where was her troop, and how had she become separated from them? Why had she approached him? For he knew well the stories of men taken by nymphs in the darkness of the night, but no tale he had heard ever spoke of a lone nymph reaching out to a man by daylight. Something was wrong here, but he did not know what it was, nor how to ask. The nymph spoke again, and extended her hand as if inviting him to take it. Before he could remember all the reasons why he should not, he did, and followed her into the trees. They walked together for hours and hours, though time did not seem to flow precisely as it should. The poacher saw the sun moving along its course, seeming to flicker across the sky as he caught glimpses of it through the leaves, but though they walked steadily, he grew neither hungry nor tired. The path was easy before them, so that he never stumbled as the nymph led him by the hand, which of course his rational mind told him was a ridiculous way to travel through a forest. And yet, he allowed himself to be led. At dusk, she slowed, then stopped before a massive oak tree, its ancient bark weathered by wind and rain and the scratchings of a thousand small creatures. She placed her free hand against it, then looked to the poacher and nodded. Unsure of what else to do, he placed his hand on the tree as well. She smiled at him suddenly, then pulled him away from the tree. Behind them, where nothing odd had been just moments ago, was a clearing lit with the last rays of the setting sun. A throne sat in the middle. It could not be anything but a throne, despite being fashioned of nothing but cunningly intertwined branches. Upon the throne sat another nymph, and seeing her, the poacher thought, even in her nakedness, she was regal enough to make a sodden pile of leaves seem a throne. "I see my daughter finally found you." The poacher, so surprised to hear words in his own tongue, almost didn't understand them at first. "Found me?" he asked. "What is this place, and why have I been brought here?" The queen, for the poacher could see she must be the nymph queen, with her flawless beauty and confident bearing, the queen fixed her rich brown eyes on him. "The apple was eaten," she said slowly, "and the single silver coin traded away at the fairy market for idle fripperies. The forest gives us all we truly need." "Well," she said, her voice heavy with amusement, "almost everything." She glanced at her daughter, and the poacher followed her gaze. The younger nymph held something in her hand for him to see. It was a lock of his hair, bound neatly with a scrap of broken bootlace. "You belong to the forest, and to her," the queen said. "She has sought you for years, but you have not made it easy for her." Looking into the daughter's eyes, he found it difficult to speak. "I didn't know," he finally managed to say. The queen seemed amused. "But you do know that we require human men for breeding, do you not? Doubtless you've heard stories, or you would not have resisted us so fiercely." "I've heard what becomes of them, yes," he said, a surge of anger lending strength to his voice. "I've no wish to end up nothing but a dried-out husk." The queen laughed. "We have no wish for that either. You are not some poor drunken traveler who does something to defile our home and is ridden to death by a whole troop as punishment. I promise no harm shall come to you. Well, unless you count a few scratches. My daughter can be rather enthusiastic." The poacher's eyes were still fixed upon the young nymph's face, and so he did not miss her blush, even though she ducked her head to try to hide it. "But me?" he asked. "I am no one. My home is the wilds, and I scratch a living out of the land, but the king's law says that makes me a criminal. I have done no great deeds, nor suffered any trials to prove I deserve the hand of a princess." "I care neither for your king nor his laws," the queen replied. "You made an offering to the spirits, and have done them honor while you have lived beneath the shelter of their trees. They accepted you, welcomed you. You are a son of the forest, fit to be the father of future queens. As for her hand, well, it is not marriage she asks of you." "Then what do you require of me?" he asked, turning to the queen. "It is simple enough," she answered. "Live among us and lay beside my daughter until she swells with child, and then you shall be free to return to your own land." "And if I refuse?" he asked. "Why would you?" she asked in return. "You only resisted because you feared your death, and I have promised you safety. Do you doubt my word?" The queen hesitated, then went on more softly. "Look at her. Do you not desire her? And she has been searching for you since that first night after you made your offering to the spirits. It is a quest that I should hope has finally come to its end." The poacher did indeed desire the nymph, who was still trying to hide her rosy blush behind the green fall of her leaves. He reached out to touch her cheek softly with the fingertips of one hand, and she looked up at him. The shy hope in her eyes made his heart swell and his body quicken. He leaned forward to kiss her, at first uncertainly, but when her mouth opened under his, any awkwardness he felt melted away. "Splendid!" the queen cried, startling the poacher into jumping back and breaking the kiss. He felt his own face heat with embarrassment, but his companion smiled at him. She took his hand and led him away from the clearing. A few minutes later, he found himself following her through a small gate formed from two trees with their thin branches woven together overhead. Beyond that portal lay a cozy little bower, open to the elements and yet still seeming somehow to be a deliberate shelter. A soft bed of moss and leaves lay in one corner, and it was to this that she led him. A moment of awkward nervousness reminded him that they shared no language in common. He wondered how her mother, the queen, had learned to speak his tongue. He wondered why, since she did speak it, she had not seen fit to teach her daughter. But then that daughter kissed him again, and he forgot all about it. Words hardly seemed necessary at a time like this. Her skin was soft and cool under his hands. While she set about undressing him, he couldn't resist running a fingertip over the leaves atop her head, so unlike the hair atop his. She giggled, a surprisingly human sound, and he laughed, and any trepidation he still felt vanished with the echoes of their laughter. Soon enough, his clothes were gone, and she pushed him down onto the moss, settling herself astride him to welcome him into her body. As they moved together, she murmured softly to him, words that he could not comprehend, but still had the flavor of lover's endearments, sweet nothings that curled around his heart like gentle fingers. When those soft murmurs escalated to shattering cries of ecstasy, he found his own release as well, planting a seed within her. Whether or not it would take hold this first time, he did not know, but feeling her arms around him as they lay together, already half asleep, he found he did not mind the idea of staying a week, a month, a season or more, until his lover's birch-pale skin stretched and swelled over the growing child she would carry. That night, lying under the stars on a bed of moss and leaves, he dreamt many strange things. But the image that remained with him when he awoke was of a little girl smiling at him, her eyes wide and blue as a summer sky, the leaves on her head as red as an autumn maple. In the first light of morning, he turned to his sleeping lover and planted a kiss on her cheek. She stirred, and his body stirred as well, and soon enough, they were trying again to bring that little girl to life.